Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
What are some of the factors that go into evaluating a business at any given time? We asked valuation expert Christopher Mercer.
It's one thing to say that your value is worth what a willing buyer and a willing seller will pay. But that same willing buyer and same willing seller won't pay the same thing in 2008 as they will in 2014. Because in 2008, the world was full of uncertainty that caused financing to dry up, and it was enormously difficult to sell. Some of your listeners that are listening to this need to think about the fact that they need to be thinking of an orderly transition of management and ownership, because when bad things happen to your company, you lose all flexibility in terms of ownership and management transition. So take care of those things now while you can.
Being in business is inherently risky. We all know that. But what are some of the most common mistakes that business owners make and their potential solutions? We asked for comments from attorney Mayar Ghassemian.
One of the important mistakes is not having a corporation or LLC or another form of entity that would limit their liability in case they get sued. I have seen a lot of companies that do this, and it's very prevalent in the construction industry. If they're around for a while and they don't have an entity, they are going to be sued sometimes, especially in construction. And what happens is, and they put their own personal properties in danger because they don't have an entity that would protect them.
What are some of the important factors that go into a professional business valuation? We asked expert Roger Winsby.
Valuation is really about a sense of future opportunities offset by the risks. And if you don't really think those through as it relates to each individual company, you won't really understand whether you might be above average on that multiple or below average, but it's going to be quite rare when you're right on the average or the median. It's quite an issue that comes up in terms of understanding, you know, the business and being able to document your findings. Valuation is really about future, and as much as, you know, people want to say, well, you know, here are my retained earnings and here's what I've done, and that's, you know, very important context, but ultimately if someone wants to buy the business, they're buying the future opportunity and weighing that against the future risks.
You know, a lot of business owners I talk to have an image in their mind of how they're going to put up a for sale sign and sell their business quickly and easily, get a big check and invest it. Here's a message from someone who's done it, Veronica Saldivar.
A lot of folks just think, I'm going to sell for X amount of dollars. And, you know, especially here for us in California and other similar states, taxes are a huge, huge consideration. It takes a big bite at your bottom line. I think also one of the other things is to consult with a CPA on that tax liability. When I was negotiating the sale of my business and negotiating the purchase and sale agreement, I also met several times with a tax attorney as well. He helped me draft the documents to prepare to make sure that I was going to fall under cap gains tax treatment, which was huge.
When you're undertaking a big project like exit planning, it's important to know that your advisors are using a specific process. Here's Leo Klein.
Our approach is to say, well, let's have initially that conversation. Let's do some initial fact finding on everything that is in, you know, that it needs to be looked at to develop that strategy. And once we sort of have developed the strategy, what we do is present that strategy in sort of in a team meeting to all the other advisors, and if needed, we bring in some new advisors if there are certain gaps. Here's the strategy, here are the facts. Let's discuss this and provide your input and suggestions. Let's refine the strategy based on your expertise, and then let's finalize it and then implement it. And then from my perspective, best practice is that sort of you repeat this process once a year until you conduct your exit.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
If you're going to grow your business, you've got to grow your sales. Here's Brad Leggett.
One of the key things we work with is performance management. How do you set targets? How do you get a sales team to perform? Because in about roughly half the companies we go into, there aren't formal sales targets in place. And that can be very demotivational to a sales team because they don't know where they're expected to perform to. You often have a very frustrated CEO or head of sales that says, well, the team's not doing well, but they haven't articulated what that target is. And our approach is you work with the sales team to set targets. I mean, the first piece of advice I've got is get a sales target that's written down and put it in front of everybody. That's step one.
Okay.
At least have that. But it's much better to set targets with the sales team's involvement. So sit down, and you don't want to walk into this meeting with a salesperson without some idea of the sales target. You'll have an idea of where it should be. Let's talk about where we think we can get to this year and what our target is.
What are some of the key things that a buyer looks for when they're buying a business? We asked a gentleman who's bought a lot of businesses, Ace Chapman, for his ideas.
The two things that we focus on when either we buy a business outright or we go in and invest in a business is we want the operations really to kind of be everything to be there. What we add on top of that is two things. Most people have not spent a lot of time investing or building out their marketing funnel. And the second part of that is having almost like a franchise-like operations manual that allows the person to come in and feel really comfortable that they're going to be able to run the business and take over from where you are. You want to stand out and have those kind of extras that just make it an easy investment for the buyer.
Technology is here to stay, and having a technology plan is becoming very important. Here's expert Jim Blue.
A lot of people have a business plan, but they don't have a technology plan. What type of equipment do I need? What type of services that I need? A large percentage of my time is helping people brush up on basic computer skills. I help them select the right equipment, programs, and services, really based on their individual needs. And anytime something new comes out, I'm getting phone calls and emails in terms of whether they should upgrade, whether they should get a new product. You know, the name of the game now is setting up a home office. Most people have some type of technology in their home. There's a big difference between using it for personal use and for using it for business use. And I have to really separate that based on how much time someone's going to be spending in their office and what they do for a living.
What are some of the trends because of the global economy? We asked international law expert Kenneth August.
You mentioned manufacturing. That's a perfect example of where the thinking today is very different from where it was even 5 years ago. And by that I mean traditionally a company might look at outsourcing their manufacturing, let's say to China as an example, in order to lower their cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
But really with the consumer markets moving into those countries where they were outsourcing, it makes a lot more sense today to look not at a unilateral outsource manufacturing play, but how can you develop a revenue base and profitability in that local market? And maybe instead of doing all your outsourcing in China, you also have manufacturing in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, and they become concentric circles of new markets that you can sell your products and services into.
Most people think of planning for their death when they visit with an estate planning attorney, but here's another viewpoint from estate planning attorney Michael Wittick.
I tell people all the time, you know, you probably came to me to plan for your death when the baby boomers' biggest problem I think, is disability. In fact, there are things worse than death, and some types of disability fall into that category. They've already done a study in 2014 and determined that in California, the average cost of long-term care is now $94,000. I would say in almost every case, I recommend that people go get a long-term care insurance consultation just so that they can find out, because that's one of the things that is rapidly changing right now to take care of this increased cost. They're repackaging it, and there are new companies in, and some older companies that used to offer it are now out of California. Things are changing in that field just like many others.
Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you. And we've got some interesting information for you today. I think you're really going to enjoy this. You might want to grab a pen and a pad of paper and sit back and take some notes. My first guest today is Gene Hino, who's been with us before from Gene Hino Incorporated. And Gene is an insurance broker, and he works in the field of health insurance, which, as we all know, is not only a sizable portion of our business budget, but it's also ever-changing. And there are more changes coming up, and we're going to talk about that. So let's get right into it with Gene. We're going to talk about health insurance. What changes do you need to be aware of? Gene, welcome back. Thanks for joining me once again on the show here.
Well, thank you, Bill. Pleasure to join you, and more than happy to assist. And yeah, there, as you said, let's get right into it. So yes, there's certainly continued changes in health insurance, as there have been every year for gosh, I forget how many years. But
yeah,
one of the changes that's happening is that there's not going to be a penalty for not having health insurance starting January 1st, 2019. Now, obviously, most people recognize they still need health coverage, but that is one of the changes that, you know, frankly, hasn't been all that well publicized.
Yeah, I had not heard of that, Gene. So this is one of the things that came in with Obamacare that was intended to incentivize or basically force people to either take health insurance or pay some kind of a tax or penalty, if you will, for not taking it. So did this just come about recently? Is this a new as we're, you know, we're shifting, as Trump's trying to shift away from Obamacare, is this one of these changes?
Yes, it sure is, Bill. Yeah, it was actually went through as law here a few months ago, and then effective for January 1st, 2019. And of course, most people still realize that, you know, hey, God forbid I'm in the hospital for a week and I've got a $90,000 bill. I need, you know, don't want to pay that out of pocket. So most people recognize that they still need some type of health coverage. But one of the interesting things that's now spawned is some non-ACA compliant plans. And this is kind of interesting, because now there's plans for both individuals, families, as well as small groups. And they define small group in California as from 1 to 100 employees. You know, now some of these non-ACA compliant plans are coming in with rates that might be 40% less than the traditional ACA compliant plans. Now, they're not right for everybody, because typically, again, depending on it, especially for individuals, families, it excludes pre-existing conditions. If somebody's on expensive brand medications, it's not right for you. Ongoing medical conditions, pending surgeries, it's not the right product. But for some people, it's got a wonderful PPO network, largest in the country, and you know, it's a viable option for the small groups. There even is some medical underwriting, whereas there's a guaranteed issue with the ACA compliant plans. So again, if obviously the larger the group, you know, you're going to have some high blood pressures, asthma, diabetes, mm-hmm. you know, some type of health situations. But for a group that's you know, reasonably healthy, it's a wonderful alternative and a tremendous savings for the business owner.
Yeah, I guess you know, we've always been taught that you get what you pay for, and you better know what you're paying for and what it doesn't pay for in health insurance. So what are some of the, I mean, if there's a 40% rate decrease, we would expect that there would be some kind of surface level limitations to some of those policies. What would we look for, Gene, to see? Would it be like a cap to the number of times you might go to a doctor or a hospital during a year or something like that, or where would the limitations fall?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a great question. And yes, exactly. Depending on the plan, there can be a limit of, say, 5 doctor visits in addition to your annual physical, which is, of course, is no deductible, mm-hmm. no copay, and et cetera. And so that is one of the limitations. Another limitation, again, depending on the plan, et cetera, might be for a given medical condition, they'd pay up to $500,000 in a given calendar year. But mm-hmm. the nice thing about it is that even if, God forbid, somebody develops some type of a health situation, they can have this health non-ACA compliant health care plan. But then they can go to a, you know, back in open enrollment time once a year, back to an ACA plan, guarantee issue, no pre-existing conditions. So, you know, depending, again, on the circumstances, you know, obviously we always ask people to do our proper discovery and fact-finding what's their situation, and it's not right for everybody, but, you know, we found where some people maybe were paying, say, $525 for a typical ACA plan, but now with a non-ACA plan, it might be $315. So now they've got, you know, $200 or so a month, $2,500 a year in savings right up front on the premium. So, you know, it can be a viable alternative for many people, and it's not well known, it's not well publicized. Even a lot of the insurance agents, you know, don't work with the plans. But yeah, absolutely, there can be nice savings depending on the situation.
Now, you know, it's very interesting, and I guess a question that comes to my mind is, will this drive employers to limit the plan that they pay for? In other words, if they were paying for, what was it before? There was like the gold plan and the silver plan, you know, the standardized plans under Affordable Care Act, as opposed, and the employer would say, well, we'll pay 100% for the silver plan. If you want the gold plan, you need to pay for the difference yourself. Will this, do you think, spawn a trend of employers saying, we'll pay for these non-compliant plans because they're 40% cheaper, because that's the basic coverage you can get, and if you want more, then you've got to pay for it, because employers are under the gun under, you know, rising wages and workers' comp rates and all kinds of other costs, so employers are getting squeezed pretty hard too. So what do you think?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, this is an evolving area, and, you know, some of the answers, you know, we frankly don't know, but yes, you're right. I mean, with the typical, for a small business, typically then you have a choice of your platinum, gold, silver, bronze plans, and what do you pay for? Do you pay, you know, 50% of a given plan, 80%, 100% mm-hmm. of a given plan, and then people can either take a plan with better benefits, lower benefits, et cetera, depending on their situation, or perhaps take a, you know, less expensive plan for dependents. But, yeah, with the non-ACA compliant plans, well, now all of a sudden, if your rates are going to be whatever the numbers are, it comes out to 20, 30, 40% in savings. Well, now sometimes the employer can say, oh, gosh, maybe we can't pay 80 or 100% of the cost of the plan, where before, you know, it was less generous benefits, or perhaps they didn't even offer a group health plan.
Yeah, one way or the other, I mean, employers are always trying to save money in this area, but yet provide some kind of coverage in most cases. Now, one other thing I noticed
is that it used to be you had to have two employees to be part of a group health plan, and it looks like now it's in many cases it's down to one, as you mentioned earlier. What happened there?
Well, that's a good question, and for practically for many people, it's 2 to 100 is a good way to think of it. But for example, if you and I owned a business, and let's say that I had group coverage through my spouse, or group coverage through Medicare, or coverage through military, whatever, I could waive off the plan. And we could have a one-person group with you, the only one enrolling, and me waiving off the coverage. So in effect, you might have two people there with the business, but only one person that is actually on the plan. So it's a little deceptive. If you're just one individual, you don't have a business, you can't have a group plan. So there does have to be a true business relationship there. Typically, you know, the most traditional ACA plans, you do need to have W-2 employees, the usual deductions for, you know, workers' comp and state, federal taxes, et cetera. But now with some of the non-ACA plans, we can even include 1099 employees, 1099 contractors, if you will, that aren't, you know, true employees by the definition. So it's a fast evolving area, and you know, these plans, you know, it does look like they're going to be available nationally. But obviously, I work, you know, primarily in California, although I'm licensed in Nevada, Arizona, you know, some adjacent states, but it does look like these are going to be viable alternatives depending on the situation and depending on what the employer, you know, can afford or wants to offer for employees.
Well, it's an interesting area of expertise because it seems like we keep hearing that, you know, things are going to get standardized. The need for the insurance agent or broker is going to be minimized. You can do this directly online through this, you know, through different things, and yet, yet things have changed now to where, again, like you said, a lot of these are quiet changes. I had not heard about some of these changes, and until you hear about it from a client who's facing a renewal, and they get all this information, and it can be very confusing. They're like, well, where did all this come from? Where did all this non-ACA stuff come from? And I'm wondering, because I've heard on the news and things like that that our current president has really quieted down the advertising that promotes enrollment availability for the Affordable Care Act type of plans and that type of a thing. So is that part of why things have gotten quiet about all these changes, or is there some other factor that we should know about?
Well, yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, in California is certainly one of the states that the federal government is looking for as far as how the exchange in California, it's the Covered California Exchange, and how it's working, because, you know, we've got about 15 to 17% of the entire enrollment in the entire nation.
Right.
Under Covered California. So, you know, some questions as far as, you know, will the federal funding be there? Now, the exchanges were set up to be self-sufficient after a certain point, and whether that's going to happen is a question mark. Covered California is very viable today in California. And, you know, as far as what the future holds, again, aside from the political situation, you know, whatever party is in power, et cetera, you know, could be a factor. But right now, you know, Covered California is viable. And a lot of people don't realize either that, you know, whether they go through me or they call a toll-free number with Covered California or with Blue Shield or with Kaiser or whatever, all the rates are the same. So, you know, the rates are filed with the Department of Insurance in the case of HMO's Department of Corporations. And so there's only one rate out there. So sometimes people think they'll save money by, you know, calling Covered California directly, being put on hold, and, you know, talk with the agent of the day on there. Whereas, you know, I can represent not only the Covered California plans, but direct to the carrier's non-ACA plans, determine whether a small group is viable, and, you know, just all the other factors that business owners don't typically have the time and desire as far as learning on all the different rules and sure. What's the latest changes? So, that's an area I think where we can be proactive and really get down to the bottom line of what's in the individual or the business owner's best interest, Bill.
Well, yeah, and everybody's, of course, everybody's very busy these days, so they're tending to the business of their business, and then all of these changes come along. I think for a lot of people, they're saying, you know, I just need somebody to interpret what these changes are and how they affect me, and what can I do? Should I look at some of these other alternatives? Now, one question I have for you, Gene, if we get our crystal balls out, mine hasn't worked since 1970 something. But if we're thinking about this Affordable Care Act dilemma here, now it seemed to me like the main reason that was going to work was the enforcement of that alternative tax or penalty you'd have to pay if you didn't get coverage gave you a reason to get coverage. If we take that incentive away, do you think a lot of people will opt out of coverage that normally would have taken it because otherwise they have to pay a penalty?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And like you see, as far as the crystal ball on what's actually going to happen, I mean, when the penalty was first put in, they did projections as far as who is going to enroll, who is not going to enroll, is it going to reduce the uninsured people. And in California, it has, for various reasons, reduced the number of uninsured people. Of course, you know, there's Medicaid, there's Covered California, there's direct to the carriers, there's group plans, etc. And one of the areas where the projections were quite off was that the younger people from 20 to 30, 20 to 40, still tended to not enroll into a plan, and many of them said, hey, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm not going to contribute, I don't have 200, 300, 400, whatever the number is per month to contribute. So a lot of them still didn't enroll, and the amount that enrolled were not as good, but yet the people that were the 50 to 64 age range, they tended to have heavy enrollment, and the uninsured in that age category did reduce dramatically, but those were the people that tended to have more claims,
right,
more health problems, and as a result, now the premiums we're seeing, and, you know, with Covered California, the average premium increase looks like it's going to be another 11% coming here January 1st, and then open enrollment for all of the individual family plans start on Monday, October 15th through December 15th for a January 1st effective date. So yes, absolutely. I mean, the projections have been a bit off, and certainly some people will now choose not to have health insurance because of not having a penalty. But yet, you know, most people still realize, hey, I need to do something. I need to have some type of coverage. And therefore, what's best for them? And that's where we just help people get the best value depending on what their situation is.
Right. Again, back to the crystal ball, the only problem with that is if you don't have those healthy premiums coming in, those users that pay but don't use, then the people that are enrolled are going to see probably higher and higher rate increases. So that's where these non compliant plans come into play, and again, that's something that I think if you're a business owner and you're starting to plan your budget for next year, you probably ought to be talking to somebody sooner rather than later about what your new options are, Gene, and that's where you come in. When you first talk to people, how far in advance of most group insurance have like a renewal date, right, like a anniversary date at which point they're free to, that most of them would make that decision to renew or change their plan, right?
Yeah, exactly. And for the groups of 1 to 100, now the carriers must get the new rates out to the group 60 days or more ahead of time. So anybody with a November, December 1st effective date or anniversary date has already gotten their renewal rates. And then the January renewal rates are going to be sent out here within, you know, sometime this month between now and October 31st. For the January 1st effective date. And so, yeah, typically you know, the business owner gets the information 60, 70 days ahead of time. And then obviously you want to start addressing this well ahead of time, because depending
yes.
on what the situation is, what doctors you want, what hospitals you want, you're going through underwriting, filling out paperwork, whether you do it online or with actual paper, it all takes a bit of time. And then, you know, we have to do what's best for the business owner, and then that has to be communicated through the employees through enrollment meetings or however the owner chooses to do it. So there's always you know, allowing enough time. You know, we can do a plan on the last day of the month for, you know, the first of the month effective
mm-hmm.
date, but practically then you're not going to get your ID cards until the plan's been enforced for 3 weeks or whatever. And so, yeah, you want to do it ahead of time if that's possible.
So here's the deal, listeners. When you're thinking group health, GH, think of Gene Hino, GH. Gene Hino is an expert in this field and can help you interpret what you might be looking at, and maybe you put it off to the side to think about it later. You should pull that back out and give Gene a call and start thinking about it now. Gene, what's the best number for our listeners to reach you at?
The best phone number to reach me is my office number is 714-734-8899. And also provide my cell number, if that's preferable, 714-403-4004. And one more time, the office number, 714-734-8899. Would an email address also be helpful, Bill?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Sure.
Sure. It's email is Gene, my first name, G-E-N-E, at kfico.com. That's Gene at K as in kangaroo, F is fantastic, I is intelligent, C is congratulations, O is outstanding.com. So again, G-E-N-E at K-F-I-C-O.com. And look forward to assisting whoever I can.
Thank you, Gene. It's all, you know, it's amazing how much we can learn from you in just 20 minutes, and we really appreciate you coming on once again to share this information and update our listeners. So I'll see you again sometime soon, and thanks so much for coming on today.
Great, Bill. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it once again. Have a great day.
All right. My next guest is Steve Weimer, who's joining us from STI Enterprises, Inc., also called sales acceleration. So that's what we're going to talk about is accelerating your sales. And we're going to talk a little bit about today customer retention and care. So, Steve, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Great, Bill. Hey, thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate the invite and look forward to this time in the air with you.
Yeah, I really look forward to this. This, you know, a lot of people are saying, I need to get more out of my customers. I need to make sure I'm retaining my customers. The world has become very competitive. So before we get into the meat of the matter, Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and STI Enterprises and what you do and what type of customers you work with?
Sure, Bill. You know, a little bit about my background. I've been involved in executive sales management and marketing for over 40 years, both domestically and globally. I began my career as a young independent sales rep for a group, and then evolved into being a Western Regional Sales Manager for that company at the age of 24. 2 years later, after I became the regional manager of this 40-year-old manufacturing company, I'd risen to become the highest-grossing regional manager in the company, and the opportunity came up where the VP of sales had left the company abruptly to go to a competitor, and being a brash 26-year-old at the time, I formulated my plan, went in and talked to the CEO and said I'd like the opportunity even though I don't have the skill set to do it, and fortunately for both of us, he had the confidence in me, and we grew that company multiple times over the next 6 years, and became the biggest market leader in our field. Since then, I've been involved in numerous small to mid-sized manufacturing businesses, typically in the $1 to $35 million range. One I was instrumental in taking from $800,000 and sagging in sales to a $32 million booming business over about 7 years, which culminated in a lucrative sale for the owners and an early retirement for them.
Nice.
And then in two, yeah. It was,
who doesn't
it was,
like
it was,
that?
It was a great. Yeah, you don't get those too often, but when they happen and you can be part of the driving force to that growth and that success, it's really an awesome situation for all. In 2012, I was brought actually the year before. In 2011, I was brought into a company by the CEO who we had worked with in other ventures, and they're a manufacturing company. We were given the opportunity to purchase that company. So several of the management people, myself included, and our CEO and one of our engineers purchased that business, and our plan was to have an exit strategy or to flip the business in 5 to 6 years, which, you know, if you look at the math, 5 to 6 years from 2002 was 07 and 08, and holy cow, that's not the time we're going to sell a business. We were just trying to survive at the time, which fortunately we did by restructuring the business, investing in new products, and we grew the business to the point in 2014 we felt timing was right to shop the company for sale, and in May we were able to culminate in the successful sale of that business and transition out to explore new opportunities, and voila, here I looked at what do I want to do with the rest of my big boy life, and I decided that I wanted to take my 40 years of experience in sales, executive sales, and marketing leadership, and offer that to small to mid-sized manufacturers in the Inland Empire, San Diego, and Orange County markets. And
that's their good fortune when they get 40 years of experience, right? And they get to talk to you about these issues. Customer retention is so important, and what I'm hearing happening with a lot of baby boomer business owners is they're saying, I understood how to entertain my customers when we were both in our 30s and 40s, but now I'm finding that there's a changing of guard at some of the companies I'm working with, and now I'm the old guy, and I don't know how to entertain these. I don't know what's relevant to some of these folks. I need to keep those relationships going. So can you tell, how do successful companies retain their customers these days? What are some of the better ways to do that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you have to understand, you really have to understand, who the customer is. It sort of sounds cliche and simple, but customer retention requires adopting a customer-centric operating philosophy and simply treating customers as you would expect to be treated yourself. And there's a lot of things involved in that. You have to understand your customers inside and out. What are their needs? What are their expectations? Are you knowledgeable about how knowledgeable are you about your competitors and how they operate? How do they compare to your company and your practices? So I think you sort of have to look at, establishing best practices throughout your company for these. When you look at who's responsible for customer retention, it's everybody in the company. The lowest person on the totem pole to the CEO is responsible for that relationship, and sort of simplifying it, looking at a manufacturing company. Is there a live attendant on your phone? Because I know so many people hate the automated attendants. A lot of companies for years hired receptionists and / administrative people at sort of the lowest end of the totem pole when that can be some of the most important relationship contacts you ever have, because that can make or break your relationship with your customer by them having a bad experience with them or anybody in the company. So you sort of have to look at, how would you want to be treated? And I sort of adopted a thing with clients I called the Slurpee method, and it's not the cold frozen drink at a 7-Eleven store. But it's simply, the S is this is really simplified, but it's smile into the phone. Customers can tell if you've had a bad day. It's not, and you need to be someone they like to call and talk to. Leave your personal issues at home. I know that may be hard, but You know, when you're at work, you've got a job to do, and your job is making sure our customers have a good experience, you know, when they work for you. And that's either talking to them or a task they've asked you to do or information they've asked you to gather, you know, just perform it in a professional manner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the you is understand the customers.
Yep. So get
you
a good understanding of them. And like you said, I mean, I've heard of some customers that are clients that have changed their title of their receptionist to director of first impressions. It's an important role. It's the initial impression that person is getting of your company right out of the gate. It ought to be positive, right?
It absolutely has to be positive. And you know, you can derail an unhappy customer, because in business, everybody has problems. There's no utopia where you know, it's just, you know, green rolling hills and elevator music. There are problems in business, and that can be your biggest chance to make the best impression on a customer, is how you handle the problem.
Yeah, it makes a whole heck of a lot of sense. And you know, I guess the question would be, like you said, it's everybody's responsibility, but is it everybody's responsibility, or how can you empower people to say, you know, I've heard the way so-and-so handles customers and it really needs some improvement? How do you create that kind of a customer-centric model, if you will?
Well, I think you have to look at every employee, and you have to get involved in training your employees. So, and giving them, one, you need to empower them. So you need to establish, you know, things that they can do and offer customers and help customers to a point, and then after that they have to pass it along to their manager. But, you know, you establish, here's the goals, here's the operating philosophy. Everybody has the same operating philosophy, but you have to put the training in, and you have to put the expectations in, that this is the expectation of the company for all of us. I don't care what position you are, but our goal is to give our customer the absolute best experience that they can possibly have, because that's going to win out over, in many cases, over pricing, over all sorts of other aspects of your business, because people deal with people. So
mm-hmm.
if you give them this great experience, it's like going to a restaurant. You have a great meal. You know, you tell everybody.
Yeah, more than ever these days, right?
You know, you have the same thing can happen if you have a horrible meal. You know, you're not going to refer that restaurant or that company to anybody else. So it really, you know, you've got to sit everybody down. In some cases, it requires training sessions, and it requires everybody to have the same list of, this is how we're going to, you know, objectives, and this is how we're going to operate as a company, both individually and collectively, to assure our customer has the best relationship, and we keep them by committing to that.
Well, so you know, we have a lot of different types of businesses as our listeners. Let's talk about one very simple area for those that might be in a service business of some kind, and they got a bad review on Yelp. Okay, now I've seen two methods of thought regarding that. One, you jump right on it and you acknowledge that there's a problem, and you create a strong follow-up component to that. Number two, you just kind of ignore it and let it go away. What's the proper way to handle that these days?
Well, it's sort of like having a problem communication with a friend, a loved one, a spouse, or whatever. By ignoring it, it gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
It festers like a wound,
mm-hmm.
and it can become infected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really the best way is to attack that in a positive manner, acknowledging what they're saying, we want to resolve this, understanding from your staff what happened, so that you have a more thorough understanding of the whole situation, and you can resolve it quickly by by simply addressing it on a positive level and say, I'm sorry if there was an issue. What can we do to fix this? I'll take care of you. And again, now you turn somebody from a total negative to, you know, hey, I had a problem. I voiced my opinion. They jumped on it. They took care of me. I'm happy.
Yeah, and I think the point there is that it's not even necessarily for that. That customer might be a lost cause. They might never come back because they had a bad experience. But other customers might be, other potential customers might be reading that review to see how you handle that. Do you blame, do you say, well, it wasn't our fault, it was your fault, and I can't, you know, because I've seen both ways where owners of businesses take on the accuser and say, well, you know, that's probably the worst thing you can do, right? I mean, don't air your battles publicly, which I think a lot of people need to understand that these days is that, yes, the customer is not always right, but they should always be treated respectfully and in a positive manner.
I totally agree. It's sort of like dealing with an employee in your company or an issue with a peer in your company, you don't address it in the hallway in the aisles of the business. You address it in private. You do it with respect for the others. Sometimes it comes down to we're going to agree to disagree. But but this is what the company needs to have done. And never air. I sort of like never air the dirty laundry in public.
Yeah, I was reading this. It was a hotel I was thinking about staying in, and I saw how the owner kind of attacked the people that had a complaint. And I'm like, well, if that's their attitude, I'll find another place. So I have another question for you, and that is that
sure.
It seems like all the major companies have adopted this Net Promoter Score as a methodology, a standardized methodology of determining who their promoters and detractors are. And I think that helps in the when you're thinking about positioning your business for sale, it helps to be able to compare your business against, let's say, Verizon or another giant company who does the Net Promoter Score. Are you seeing that as the standard, kind of the adopted standardized methodology? And number two is, what should someone do if they see if they use that and they get a low score from someone? Should they jump right on that, or how should they attack that?
Well, I think in the bigger companies and definitely in tech and so forth, they're using the Net Promoter Score, but a lot of companies aren't, and they're not knowledgeable about that. But for my recommendation for those that are utilizing that, and absolutely, and if you're looking at an exit strategy, you have to have your relationships really really solid, and that not only means, I mean, like I said before, that means everybody in the company, and looking at that and saying, okay, let's research the issue. What is the issue? What do they think? What do we think? What did we do? Here's the deal. Sometimes you just have to fall on your sword and suck it up and say, my bad, we did that. Yes, it wasn't right, but I'm gonna fix it. So you can always fix those scores, and you can always, typically mm-hmm. always mm-hmm. always fix those relationships. Never say never, because it can be. Maybe it's an immediate win back that you've got the customer back on your side. Sometimes it takes time. Sometimes it takes time for the wound to heal.
And I'm sorry for our listeners for using that terminology. I got a tweet here. The Net Promoter Score is simply that question you see all the time that says, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to refer us to or tell us tell someone about us in a positive manner, or refer in a relative or whatever. So it's that 1
sure.
to 10 scale, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is a lot of the major companies have created a score out of that they can compare against each other. And that's so important, because you could say, yeah, we get thank you letters from our clients, but, well, yeah, but what's your Net Promoter Score? Do you take customer service mm-hmm. seriously? And I think that's a big part of when you're trying to demonstrate and show up well in a beauty contest and sell your business, it's important to have something like that. Steve, when you get involved with someone, what are some of the first things that you do with someone or the first questions that you ask?
Well, some of the things I like to find out when I'm interviewing with a new potential client is, get to know them, get to know what their goals and objectives are in their company, sort of do a mini deep dive sales acceleration, and I have a quick 10-question survey that CEOs or business owners, managers can take, and it grades them on a scale of 1 to 100 against best practices of successful companies, and gives and it's really a sort of a test of their sales program and their sales department, and gives them a score, and then gives them some recommendations of change. Once we get involved, we have a much more deep dive test and evaluation procedure that we go through. But you know, the one thing we want to know is, you know, what are your goals for this year? How are you tracking to your goals? And typically, some of the responses with the smaller companies is, I want to grow 10%, I want to grow 30%, I want to grow 20%. And I said, so what's your do you have a nav app on your phone? And they go, well, what does that have to do with this? And I say, well, you know, if you're going to get to point A from point B, you don't know how to get there. You have a nav app, you can plug in the coordinates or the address, and it takes you there. What nav app do you have for your business? Which really comes down is what your sales and strategic, your sales strategic and tactical plan. And sometimes it's deer in the headlights. No, we just want to grow 10 or 20%. So really, you know, understanding that, and then actually writing the sales plan and the strategic and tactical elements of that, and then implementing it and establishing KPIs to manage it and really working with the company intimately and in depth, but on a part-time basis. Sales Acceleration is a network of over almost 100 advisors nationally. I'm one locally in Southern California, and there's several of us in Southern California. But we work on an outsourced basis. So my typical engagement is, one day a week, maybe it's 8 to 12 hours total with, direct meetings and office work. So,
well, you're the only one I know of with 40 years experience, Steve. So it's certainly shown through today. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but I do want to leave our listeners with a good way to get in touch with you. What's the best way for them to contact you?
Probably the best way is my email address, which is sweimer, S-W-E-I-M as in Mary, A-R, at Sales Acceleration, and that's sales with an X, and then Celeration, C-E-L-E-R-A-T-I-O-N, or my phone number at 909-519-1315, or they can connect with me through LinkedIn.
Terrific. Great information, Steve. I really appreciate you coming on, and I'm sorry we just scratched the surface today, so I look forward to us having another conversation and getting deeper into it. We've been talking about customer retention and care with Steve Weimer of STI Enterprises. And, Steve, thanks so much for coming on. I look forward to the next time.
Bill, pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me. You take care.
My next guest today has been with us many times, and he's back to talk about family roles and responsibilities. We've talked about so many different things about businesses. It's just a treat to have him on again. He is Vince Mastrovito from Prometheus Partners. And Vince, I think without further ado, if our listeners don't know you by now, they certainly will after today. But thanks so much for coming on once again.
Bill, really appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for having us on again. Really, really love being on your show.
Yeah, I love having you on, Vince. We've tackled quite a bit of. I think we're creating a novel of podcasts here that all tie together. And today we want to talk a little bit about family roles and responsibilities in businesses. By the way, listeners, if you go to our ExitCoach Radio website, you can find Vince's interviews and listen to them in the past. So we won't say too much, except that he is a fantastic business advisor in the area of Grand Rapids and has, again, shared many great tips with us. So, Vince, let's get right into the meat of the matter today. Family roles and responsibilities. What can you tell us?
Well, the more I work with closely held businesses, Bill, the clearer it is for me to understand who is actually doing what and what are the responsibilities of all the people. When we have the family dynamics of what's happening inside of a business, I think it is imperative for the owner and the board of directors and the people in charge advisory board that he or she is really directing or writing out a plan that is going to be able to not only sustain the business, but have people understand what is it that everyone here is doing, what's your role for the business, and why is it important to this business, and what are those responsibilities that you bring back. Primarily, I'm referring to what happens when the family has different types of shareholders inside of the business, and that could be active and inactive shareholders. And in the case that I'm kind of referring to, it was kind of like a hardware store where you had a couple of non-active shareholders that were in the business, and they were really trying to continue to take the dividends from the company when, in fact, two of the other shareholders, one was a CEO and one was the president, they were looking at expanding the business into a couple of other states, which would have at least initially reduced the dividends down or eliminated them. And there ended up being kind of a battle between, because one just wanted the income and the other ones wanted to continue to grow the business. And so when you take a look at roles and responsibilities, we have to try to understand is what is your role and responsibility as an active or inactive shareholder, and to make sure that you have that clarity so that you don't have this type of friction in between the shareholders.
That's a great point. And sometimes that can happen because the owner dies and leaves the company to maybe his two or three children, one of them that works in the business and two that don't, and they have conflicting objectives right out of the gate, right? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it just wasn't planned well and it happens in family transfers. What types of steps can companies take to communicate and figure out how best to handle that before it happens?
Well, I think the first case is when you have the shareholders at a meeting is to clearly understand what is the vision of the company and what are we trying to accomplish here? Are we looking for growth? And you have to make sure that all of the shareholders are on the same page. Along with the other things of values and what they're trying to offer in the marketplace, if all of the shareholders do not agree on the path of where everything is going and you don't have that type of communication and understanding and clarity, then you are ultimately going to have friction and disagreement, which on the flip side is really just going to cause a tremendous amount of disagreement, havoc, and can really have a negative impact on the business as a whole.
Yeah, unhappy Thanksgivings.
All the time.
Again, the situation could have come from an unintentional estate planning mistake, or that now you, the patriarch, the owner of the business, because you didn't plan properly, now you've caused a fight within your family. You've caused conflict. And certainly, I don't think very many people would have intended that. They just thought, well, this way everybody gets a piece of the business, right? So I'm just, mm-hmm. That's one way that can happen. But the other way is that, let's say, I'm working with situations right now. There are multiple siblings that own a business that inherited from dad, and some of them have kids that will take over and run the business, and others have kids that really don't want anything to do with the business, and they're trying to figure out what do I do? So sitting down and having those meetings and talking about the goals of the business, would it make sense to maybe give people a chance to say, well, if you want to be bought out, you can be bought out, but we're not going to pay dividends. We're going to grow this thing, and that's where you're going to make your wealth. Just clear communications like that.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, when you understand what the goals are, just like any other process that you're going is, how much do you want to grow the business? How much risk is the business going willing to accept? Do we all agree upon that? What is our overall profitability? What are we really shooting for? What kind of liquidities do we want? So when you take a look at these four key areas, I think these are very, very important for all shareholders, really the entire business, to understand is, what are we really trying to accomplish here? But when we're dealing with family members that may be active and inactive, it is imperative that everyone is on the same page so that the business can stay healthy and move forward and allow it to seek the level that it is has that opportunity to, so that we don't have this type of bickering inside of the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that is, it's very unpleasant to be around if anybody's ever been in a situation like that where a family is bickering, and it's very unpleasant to be an employee that's not a family member of that type of a business. And so it makes it very difficult for those types of businesses to attract key talent if they know there's going to be bickering. They don't want to be part of that. That puts them at a disadvantage as well. So let's talk about the roles and responsibilities issues for a second, Vince. People, you know, why is it important to have roles and responsibilities within a family business?
Well, I think the importance goes back to my initial comment, is it helps everyone understand what their expectations are, and it helps the business to perform at its highest level when you understand as an owner and even as a non-owner what your roles and responsibilities are. To your point, if you're out in the general marketplace after you have left the office for a particular day and you do not take into account the responsibilities you have as a shareholder of the business, as a business owner in the community, as an employer to the employees, and you're out doing things that could be looked at that maybe would be unfavorable, you know, that is really having the community and your competitors and your customers looking at you to say, well, gee, what kind of a business are they really running there? So I think it's important to have all of those understandings. If you have a board of directors or an advisory board, is that you are actually communicating to these channels to help them understand more clearly what it is that we're really trying to accomplish here and how are things moving along and moving forward, and are we really meeting our objectives or exceeding them over the current calendar year and for the future over into the next year or the year after if you're looking at a 2 to 3 year projection.
And in most family-owned businesses, you know, you're going to have a dual capacity. If you're the owner, you might be the owner and the president. You might be the owner and the vice president. You might be the owner and the manager of sales or finance. Or, you know, you're going to have your role, right? And so how important is it to understand in meetings whether is this an owner's meeting or is this a manager's meeting, and what's the difference between those two types of meetings?
Yeah, so the first meetings I kind of mentioned earlier, the first part of our conversation would be strictly for the owners of the company, where the owners are getting together to talk about the vision and the goals and what they want for the family. What is their stewardship and their legacy? What are they really trying to accomplish and bring back to the community? Things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you're talking with the managers and the key people with inside your business, I always kind of look at it from an explanation perspective, is it's kind of like the airplane. The owner has bought and built the airplane, and the managers are the ones that fly it and maintain it while it's in flight and when it stops flight, to make sure that the engines and everything else are brought up to where they should be from a compliance perspective. And so the owner is driving the plan and the strategic business outline, and then the managers and the people under the managers are actually executing everything. And so when you look at roles and responsibilities, it takes us back to a previous conversation we had, Bill, which is owner dependency. And when you look at these two things and you have that division between the two, where the owner is doing the business strategy, now you have also incorporated a business that is less dependent on the owner, and it will then most likely become much more profitable, sustainable, and a business that is much more attractive to another buyer and also is transferable.
I like that a lot, and I like the analogy of the plane where the owner is setting the course, and the managers are flying the plane. Is the way I think you put it. That makes it very clear that when you're talking together as managers of the, and you might be executives, but you're managing the business, it's more tactical and task oriented, as opposed to this, like you said, the stewardship legacy, the vision, the strategy. You know, what do we stand for? Where are we going? And then setting that course so that everybody understands. We're talking now as owners. I always thought that family businesses and small businesses in general ought to have hat racks with various hats in their office that describe their role. So when someone, for instance, when a father and a son are talking, it's like, are you talking to me as a son or are you talking to me as the VP of sales? Let's figure out which hat you're wearing right now, because that's a dynamic you don't have in many non-family businesses. You don't have that second hat to wear.
No, but I think it takes me to another point that I wanted to try to discuss today, Bill, was, I think when you talk about building or making a owners, right? So who is the next owner besides the original owner, and how do you become a good owner of a business? And I think that just that happens over time. You know, people, we are not born to be an owner of a business or a good owner. There's skill sets that we may have that other people don't have. But most of this you have to learn as you go through. And as a young person that would be coming up inside of a family business, when I go back to roles and responsibilities, is in order to continue with the stewardship of roles, responsibilities, is that the current ownership needs to be mentoring and illustrating to the younger owners what the importance are and the important pieces of being an actual business owner. And some of that is obviously how do you treat other people, that the business comes first and that we have to continue to grow the value of the business. But some of the other things are how do you actually read a financial statement? And so what we have suggested to many of our clients with younger siblings or kids coming into the business is, let's spend some time and actually even have your CPA come in and let's talk a little bit about the financial statements and what they actually mean. Or even if your children are not on or are a current shareholder, is have them attend a shareholder meeting to understand the financial pieces of the business so that they really start to get an idea and understand clearly of what that means. And then I also think it's important is to give them information to read. Send them to some one-day classes or half-day classes. And I just think you can't give them enough reading material to read. You know, short books, long books, white papers, podcasts, workshops. I think have them go talk to one of your friends that owns another business and ask them some questions and learn what it's like to be a really good owner.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Some people learn that on the job, and that's probably the wrong time to learn it. I was reading an article last night about the founder of Groupon, which grew faster than any company ever. It went from something like 10 to 1,000 employees in a couple of months, and he said the hardest part was 10 to 100. After that, it was just, you know, it was. But at that point, he said he had to become a real business. He went from an idea guy to a real business owner, and he just started reading voraciously. And the first book he read was Good to Great by Jim Collins, which he said was terrific. I mean, so he just became a voracious reader, and it's so important for people that are going to be a business owner to take that seriously and realize there's a lot of great information they need to learn, because the current owners figured it out one day at a time. I call it a teaspoon of knowledge at a time, and now there's a gallon of knowledge, and they have to figure out what is that gallon of knowledge. It's so important. So what makes, in your mind, we've talked about some of the ways to become an owner. What makes a good owner? What are some of the traits of a good owner that we can point to?
Well, I think some of the traits you look at is what type of leadership does the current owner have, and what are they really doing with the family internally to educate them and allow the younger generation to ask questions. You should be willing to open up discussions at certain times that they have the ability to ask questions as to, well, why do you do things this way? And what happens if, you know, just things about the business that will help them better understand how the business functions and why you run the business a certain way, but also how does that allow the business to move into the next generation and then the next decade of business? Because as we all know, each decade brings us different challenges economically, and sometimes the younger generations can actually bring us some pretty fresh and unique ideas. So I think by that is one key thing that I have always shared with business owners is don't be afraid to let your kids ask you questions and really sit down and have some heart-to-heart conversations and help them understand what it takes and what it is to be an owner of this business. I really think that's important.
That's a great point. Just making it being accessible and approachable for to be able to transfer informal knowledge about the company and sharing how you started the business. A lot of young owners want to know, you know, what was it like to start this thing, and they've just seen the success side of it in many cases. Sometimes the struggles, of course. But Vince, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the show, and you share so much wisdom with us. How can we help you if you have a client or a situation? How can people best get in touch with you to just talk with you and learn more about how you might be able to help them?
Yeah, well, if they would like to reach out and call us, they certainly could do this at 616-622-3070, or they could just email me at Vincent@Prometis, that's Pro, M-E-T-I-S, partners.com. Certainly our website, PrometisPartners.com, has a tremendous amount of information, educational information in there, and you can schedule an appointment or shoot an email over to us if you have an additional question or so that you want to talk about. But those are probably the best ways to really get a hold of us and ask whatever questions that you like.
And I hear from so many people that in doing that, you're very giving of your time and your knowledge, and they don't have to have necessarily a pressing need to get in touch with you. They can call and ask some questions, and you're there for them. And the people that do hire you are always happy that they have, because obviously you care very much and you communicate so clearly. So thank you once again for sharing your knowledge with my listeners today, and always a pleasure to have you on. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you so much, Bill. Really appreciate it. Have a great day.
All right, you too. All right, that's going to do it for our show today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us, and thank you once again to all of my great guests today.
Hey everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your...